Cognitive behavioral therapy is one of the most popular forms of psychotherapy in America. Almost every month, some new study is released indicating its effectiveness. But the psychologist credited with creating the intellectual foundations of CBT wasn't always lauded by the mental health community. Reporter Elise Spiegel has a profile of Dr. Albert Ellis, the wildly eccentric character behind what is now America's second favorite form of talk therapy. His critics and some listeners may find him offensive.
Some say Dr. Albert Ellis is a foul-mouthed sexual revolutionary. Others that he is one of the most influential psychologists of the 20th century. On a recent spring morning, Ellis held a seminar for 40 or so therapists eager to learn his method.
All humans are out of their goddamn minds. All of them. Biologically and sociologically, as we'll show you.
For 2 hours, the therapist furiously scribbled notes while Ellis methodically outlined the tenets of his therapeutic approach. Then, with a twinkle in his eye, Ellis asked them to put down their pencils and pull a white sheet of paper from their folder of seminar materials. In bold black print at the top of the paper were the following words: Rational Humorous Songs by Albert Ellis, Ph.D. He had them skip over I Wish I Were Not Crazy, sung to the tune of Dixie, to go directly to one of his favorites, Perfect Rationality.
Okay, ready, go. Some think the world must have a right direction, and so do I, and so do I.
Despite Albert Ellis's rather famous eccentricity, or maybe because of it, Ellis's ideas have had an enormous impact on mental health. He is widely credited with initiating what is now popularly known as cognitive behavioral therapy, though Ellis calls his particular brand rational emotive behavioral therapy. Whatever the name, it's the therapeutic approach used by 1 in 4 mental health professionals in America. To give you some sense, the Canadian Psychological Association ranks Ellis as the single most influential psychologist in the last 100 years. Number 2 is Sigmund Freud.
Rationality must be a perfect thing for me.
Ellis grew up in New York, a naturally shy person who decided early on to systematically challenge his own inhibitions. For example, when Ellis was 19, he found it difficult to approach women he found attractive. So every day for a month, Ellis forced himself to go to the Bronx Botanical Garden with the express purpose of confronting his anxiety.
And whenever I saw a woman sitting on a park bench alone, I'd sit on the same bench and give myself 1 minute to talk to her. If I die, I die. F*** it.
One of the eccentricities Ellis is most famous for is his colorful language. Anyway, over the course of the month, Ellis talked to about 130 women. He made one date, one, and the woman never showed. But Ellis still considered the experiment a success.
I saw philosophically, cognitively, that nothing happened. Nobody cut my balls off. I had 100 pleasant conversations.
When Ellis eventually decided to become a psychologist, he carried this lesson with him, that through conscious work, you can control your feelings. According to Ellis, if you want to live a healthier life, you have to force yourself to systematically challenge and reinterpret the events in your life that most disturb you, to retrain your thinking. And no event is too difficult or traumatizing.
We say that nothing is awful. Nothing. Rape, incest, terrorism, Hitler, it isn't awful.
It's not that events like rape or war aren't bad. They are. But according to Ellis, a rational person would recognize that the world is inherently unfair, and you always have a choice about your response.
When something bad happens, you can easily upset yourself, but you always have a choice to feel sorry, regretful, frustrated, annoyed, and not depressed, anxious, and despairing.
And when patients exhibit despair as a result of what Ellis deems to be fundamentally irrational expectations, he's never shy about confronting them. It's Friday night, and the auditorium of the Albert Ellis Institute in New York City is overflowing. Each Friday, the doors open to the public, and Ellis invites two or three volunteers from the audience on stage for a consult. Tonight, his assistant, Debbie Jaffe, has selected a pale teenager who sits on the platform with her arms crossed. Because she speaks softly, and Ellis is hard of hearing, the microphone is passed back to his assistant, who explains the girl's problem again, a murder which happened 8 years ago.
Kirsten's sister was shot dead. Was shot by a murderer.
Somebody you don't know.
Right. And she can't understand how someone could be alive who did that.
Ellis has asked that NPR not use the girl's voice, but she's very clearly upset. She tells Ellis that she doesn't know how to go on with her life.
The answer is you can go on with it by going on with it. You are saying that it shouldn't have happened. She shouldn't have been killed. And I say she should have been killed. Because that's what happened. That's reality. She got killed. Too bad.
Ellis doesn't condone murder. But he wants the girl to release her destructive anger over a reality that cannot be altered. This kind of therapy, where a therapist actively confronts a client's unrealistic beliefs, was revolutionary when Ellis first began practicing. At the time, the monastically silent psychoanalyst was the only acceptable model, and John Norcross, former president of the American Psychological Association's psychotherapy division, says that Ellis's new approach was universally condemned by mental health professionals.
Called simplistic, superficial, and potentially harmful.
But it wasn't just his therapeutic approach that got Ellis into trouble. He was also reviled for the wildly liberal sexual attitudes he championed. Ellis thought that homosexuality was normal and that masturbation was a good idea. But what has made Ellis a legendary figure in psychology was not just the fact that his ideas were often ahead of their time. Ellis was also an incredibly prolific propagandist. He has written over 75 books and hundreds of papers. And Norcross says this kind of advocacy is important. He points out that according to a famous theory of how scientific ideas evolve, called the Kuhnian notion of paradigms, most science comes to prominence not only through solid empirical testing, but also because of the force of particular charismatic personalities.
Someone has to come along and forcibly shake up the status quo, and that person needs to be powerful, innovative, and largely unbothered by most colleagues' negative criticisms early on. Al Ellis did that perfectly with cognitive therapy.
In fact, Ellis has been so successful in promoting his therapy that on the occasion of his 90th birthday party, the psychologist got birthday greetings from former President Clinton and the Dalai Lama. And that's not all.
I was just invited to a Bush dinner.
You were? Are you going to go?
No, of course not.
Love me, only me, or I will die without you.
Today, 29% of psychologists identify themselves as having a cognitive behavioral orientation. Among college professors who teach psychology, the percentage is even higher, 50%. This means that the next generation of psychologists will be overwhelmingly cognitive in approach. The singing sexual liberationist has made it mainstream. For NPR News, this is Elise Spiegel in Washington.
Love me with great tenderness. And no whips or butts, dear. For if you love me somewhat less, I'll hate your goddamn guts, dear.
Tomorrow, our series on CBT concludes with a report on teenagers with depression.